signing up, the hashtag is BH Series, one word. Bill, we're going to have to talk about that. I'm talking about that with Matt. He's a technology guy here. I need some more tweeters. Okay. Well, today's event is made possible by three sponsors who are outstanding supporters of the recovery community. Medavance Billing Service and Redwood Recovery Solutions are our 2016 panel series thought leadership partners, and they're supporting this educational series across the country. We were in Nashville yesterday, and then I drove down on I-24 and 75 to Atlanta today. Bill was smarter than me, and he flew. Right, you flew yesterday? How long was that flight, 20 minutes?
33 minutes.
It took me 4 hours. So it was a very nice drive. No radio stations. The other sponsor of today's event, all the way from the Maryland, D.C. area, is Credible Behavioral Health Software. And they're also sponsoring this event and others across the country. Now it's my pleasure to introduce today's panelists. All the way on my right is Matt Dorman. He is the co-founder and CEO of Credible Behavioral Health Software. Matt has more than 20 years of experience in technology management, operations, finance, and investment banking, and 18 years of political and government understanding and knowledge. Now, Matt has driven Credible with a startup, with a mission to improve the quality of care in behavioral health to a profitable, financially stable company with over 240 contracts and annual revenues exceeding $20 million. Matt, can you tell us a little bit about Credible Behavioral Health Software?
Sure. So we have 5 hours for this.
Well, more like maybe 50 seconds.
Yeah. So in a nutshell, Credible Behavioral Health is enterprise software for agencies, both small agencies, large agencies. Our mission is clearly to improve the quality of care. While we are privately held and we are for profit, we're very mission-based. In my background, I often tell people I come from the dark side. I used to do investment banking and turnarounds. Before that, I worked on the Hill and worked in politics, ran a couple different campaigns, worked for Senator Sarbanes of Sarbanes-Oxley, and also worked for Senator Al Gore when he ran for vice president. And I was very fortunate to actually be with Senator Gore on the day that he actually invented the internet, which has worked out really well for me in the long run. But in all seriousness, I started Credible to bring technology to behavioral health. I grew up with three older sisters. I lost one of my sisters to an individual that had gone off of his medications, had a psychotic episode, and once the dust settled, realized that it was a very paper-based system, not a whole lot of technology, and society as a whole values our time at a parking garage. Like, how many spots are there on level one or level two? Society values that kind of technology as opposed to agencies or individual practitioners being able to know from a clinical point of view, the key drivers. Where are our clients on medication compliance or non-compliance? So long story short, we're very mission-based. For me, it's about improving the quality of care. We have been fortunate through a lot of hard work and team building to have over 300 agencies now, 53,000 people log into Credible daily to do clinical and billing, and we process over $3 billion, Medicaid, Medicare, and third party. So we know a little bit about getting paid, so gladly share that.
Perfect. Thank you, Matt. I did not know. I've known Matt for probably 10 years, if not more. I did not know he worked on Senator Gore's campaign. So you learn something new every day. Very interesting. Well, to Matt's left is Jason Bryan, also very interesting gentleman. Jason is the founder and CEO of Redwood Recovery Solutions family of brands, including treatmentcalls.com, 1-800-ADDICTS, treatmentattorneys.com, and some other services as well. Jason actually has a very interesting background. He's an entrepreneur who started a website called Auto Cricket. He could tell you what that's about. I don't know where the cricket came from. But it ended up being a multi-million dollar company. And then a few years later, he decided to turn his passion and interest into the treatment and recovery field. And Jason, would you tell us a little bit about Redwood?
Of course, Doug. Thank you. So a lot like Matt, I thought I came from the dark side, which was automobile sales and insurance sales, and ultimately was probably just finishing high school around Al Gore time. So I don't know if that dates me, but I'm okay with that. The right out of high school, I started in the automobile business, and ultimately out of necessity, and kind of from that realized that there was an opportunity to connect people with dealerships all over the country. Ultimately, after doing that for 5 or 6 years and growing it from being two guys in an office to 450 in three countries, we kind of took a step back and we said, hey, when you're 5 and 6 and 7 years old, you don't wake up in the morning and say, when I grow up, I want to sell insurance leads. You don't wake up and say, I want to sell new car leads. You want to do something like be a vet or be a doctor, or be a lawyer. You want to do something that makes a difference. And so we kind of turned our energy to an industry that at the time we knew more in the same way that Matt did, as an accessory, as somebody that wasn't necessarily directly affected by it, but certainly had loved ones and individuals in our path that have been affected. So we wanted to get involved in an industry that ultimately made a difference in people's lives, both the people that are afflicted and the people that that the sphere of influence affects. And so from that was birthed Redwood, now Treatment Calls, 1-800-ADDICTS, and several other brands that we'll talk about. But Redwood is a marketing company at our core. We deal with about 1,000 people a day that are calling in from all over the country seeking help. And ultimately, it's our job in one form or another to get them to a treatment center. We take that very seriously. We have a team of folks in South Florida that literally listen to, with the consent of both the person calling and the treatment centers, these calls, so that we can understand and better analyze how to handle and deal with people in crisis. We're able to better understand the process of finding help in an industry where the word anonymous is so often used. We have an obligation when people reach out to us for the first time to be a source of information and help. So we really pride ourselves on being that, understanding it, learning from it every day, growing from it, and ultimately growing together with the treatment centers and the people that we serve every day.
Perfect. Thank you, Jason. And then last but not least, to Jason's left is Bill McCormick, who I'm sure you'll find today is just a very shy guy. He won't say anything on this panel. Actually, you'll find out quite differently. Bill is a highly experienced healthcare professional with comprehensive skills in strategic planning, sales, operational management, and implementation. He's currently the CEO of Medivance Billing Service, and throughout his professional career, he has demonstrated the ability to lead diverse teams of professionals to new levels of success in the very competitive healthcare field. So, Bill, can you tell us a little bit about Medivance and your mission?
Well, good morning. I'm happy to be back. Georgia's my home state. I was born 3 hours south of here. When we travel across the country, it's important that you kind of stay connected to the roots, so I'm always happy to be in the south. But on behalf of the 164 full-time employees at Medivance Billing Service, I welcome you to this session today. We're the revenue cycle management of the billing service in this space since 2007, and part of our whole mission is to help educate the community, whether they are clients or not, about the things that impacts their ability to get paid for the services they render. And part of our quest, and thanks to Jason and to Matt and other sponsors who's agreed to support this across the country, it is important for us as our culture that we share that information, we become transparent, and we be able to deliver information that is helpful to every single provider in this space. So this morning, I'm sure you will learn something different that you have not heard or learned or knew of prior to this workshop this morning. So with that being said, I look forward to dialoguing with you and answering whatever questions that Doug have designed for us today. And I hope that as a provider, you understand that those seeking sobriety really depends on what you do and also what we offer. So I want to make sure that we're clear on that mission. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. I am delighted these panelists are here for you today. I will now move into the panel portion of today's discussion And you'll surely have some questions. If you have questions, just write them down, sit on your hands, and at the end, I will come around, I guess you could say, I don't want to say Ricky Lake style, we'll call it Phil Donahue style, maybe it'll be Jerry Springer style, I'm not really sure, but I'll bring you the mic, and you'll have your opportunity to ask your questions to the panelists as well. So, who do I start with first? Well, this is my first time doing a panel with Matt, so I'm going to start with Matt, put Matt in the hot seat first. Matt, you know, as we talk about this concept of getting paid in behavioral healthcare, I think one of the challenges for the behavioral healthcare field is that there's been a lack of data. There's been a lack of data available at providers' fingertips, no matter what size organization they are, private practice all the way up to large treatment center. And I'm curious, what are you finding when you're talking to your clients across the country? What's the most critical data to have at your fingertips to ensure that you receive prompt reimbursement for your services?
So the data question is a broad one. I mean, if you're looking, and I always like to answer questions in terms of if you went back to your office, agency, et cetera, this afternoon, what can you put into play right away? So, I mean, the biggest component around data when you're trying to get paid is having the accurate information on the service readily available. And I've seen people do that with total paper systems and a great deal of manpower. There's a group up in Boston that used to have 65 people in their billing department before they went electronic. And they were doing a good job getting paid. After they went electronic, they brought it down to a group of like 8 to 10. So the key thing about data is having the right data at the right time. And the second thing that I would stress would be stepping back, looking at the data, and making sure you're valuing your time. So if you're talking to payers about getting paid, you want to be on the phone. A, you need to find the right people, which can be a challenge. B, you want to be fighting the right fight. You don't want to fight for a receivable that's over 60 days that's worth $12.56. You want to be on the phone for something that is 15 days, but it's 200, 300, 400, the bigger ticket items. So when you're looking at your data, make sure it's worth your time. Make sure you have the information. You know what the payers are going to ask for. And make sure that you analyze your data as best you can. And we can talk later about the concept of aging versus smart aging. Most people, any financial people in here? Any CPAs? Okay. So, you know, I've got an MBA in finance. I've run a couple different companies, grown a lot of companies. And everyone talks about aging, 30, 60, 90. And I think that is the worst thing that people can do. Because if you have a payer that's actually going to pay you on day 8, and you're waiting until day 30 to hammer them, you just gave up those days of cash flow. So you want to look at smart aging and when the payers could be paying you, as opposed to just waiting for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days to get upset and get on the phone. The next level would be looking at your high dollar items on the revenue side or the expense side and going after those first in your aging, not necessarily 30 days or 60 days. So if there's a service that costs you $50 or $100 to provide, you want to go after the $100 one first. Not necessarily, again, waiting for 30, 60. So those are the big things with data.
Mm-hmm. And Jason, you know, we're talking about data. Jason, all the gentlemen up here are data guys. They love data. I'm sure they would live in an Excel spreadsheet if they could. Jason, so Matt told us about, you know, data in terms of collections and prioritizing, using data tools to prioritize which receivables to go after. And let's take that data conversation a little different direction now, and let's talk about I should have started with you first. When we talk about data on the admissions process, or when you're first bringing clients in the door, before you can even bill for the services, what are you seeing? You've collected a lot of data on the admissions process, more data than probably anyone else, frankly, has, because you've worked with a lot of treatment centers. What are you seeing, and what do you think needs to be improved in that data collection process, just to even find out, are these people a good fit for you before you even bring them in for services?
So again, to reiterate how we put data together, because I think this is important in understanding, we put together what we call chronological dispositions on every single call that comes in. So in other words, what's happening on a call and in what order and at what time point in a call. So we're documenting that on every single call that comes in across dozens of treatment centers all over the country. So the data points that we collect aren't geographically specific. They're not size of center specific. It's just kind of a global look. And as an aggregate, one thing that we see is, and this is just, it's a very basic thought, but you would be so surprised, about 8% of our calls go completely unanswered by the treatment centers. So let me paint this picture for you. The treatment centers that are getting our calls are paying for them. They get to pick the hours of the day that they're going to receive those calls from us. This leaves this giant question mark for me. What about the calls that are coming off of other sources that you don't have the flexibility of time? They might come in at 1 o'clock in the morning. They might come in at 7 o'clock at night. With us, you're taking calls from 9 to 5. What happens after that? So if there's 8% of our calls that are being missed, the people are paying for, what's happening outside of that? We have had centers that are as high as a third of the calls that they've purchased from us go completely unanswered. That's what we consider an unanswered call is a call that literally goes unanswered or hits somebody's voicemail. That's another thing to consider with this. How are you routing calls and where are they being routed to? Because so often it's getting routed to somebody's cell phone, which is not inherently a bad problem, but it is when it's like, yo, it's me, Bill. Sorry I missed you. And you hear that, and it's some music in the background, right? Because it's going to somebody's personal cell phone, right? That's not necessarily the vision and the view that you want these people hearing. You want to be well represented when they call if they end up hitting a voicemail, which they shouldn't. There's real easy technology and software solutions that will allow you to roll calls over. If somebody doesn't pick up, there's somebody else lined up from a succession perspective. So lots of really easy things that we can do to avoid that. The second stat, and we can go into tons and tons of stats, but the second one that I think is really important to this room from the admissions perspective, and I would challenge you to go back to your admissions departments and ask this question, is about 20% of our calls get to the insurance information before they get to the person's first name. So in other words, the phone call comes in, hi, it's Jason. I'd like to route you to the right person. May I have the name of your insurance provider? So we're not asking any kind of question that has anything to do with the humanity of what's going on in this issue. These people are being treated and oftentimes like an insurance policy, like a form of payment, not like a person. I think about it often. I was walking into the grocery store down by us, which is a Publix. I don't know if you guys have Publix up here, but I'm walking in and I was thinking, what if the cashier asked me for my credit card before I started shopping? I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about, isn't it? We're talking about, can I see your form of payment before you're allowed to ask me questions, before I'm allowed to tell you what I'm here for, right? These are just very basic kind of human things that, you know, that I think could use some dramatic improvement in this space. And what's really interesting is on the other, just call it 80% of the calls that do get answered that aren't asked insurance information, oftentimes new forms of payment like, oh, I can call, you know, my grandma, I can call my aunt, I can call somebody else to help me get money to go to treatment. Those things come up a lot more frequently when you treat people right. So getting paid in behavioral health, getting paid, starting the process, happens way more frequently when somebody's asked questions. They're saying, hey, what's going on? Hey, can you tell me what started this? What prompted this? Most people that are calling in, that are making a decision to, again, think about it from our perspective. They're not reaching out to a pastor. They're not reaching out to a loved one. They're not reaching out to a friend or a family member. They're calling a toll-free number that they saw on TV or they saw on the internet, right? Something happened that made them get to the point where they were ready to call that number. We're not asking that information. We're asking insurance information. So, I mean, just high-level stuff, answer the phone, and then treat people like people up front, and you'll end up getting the payment way more often when you do that?
There's two aspects of data, operational data and then industry data. Matt alluded to the operational data. When you receive the information, particularly on billing, you want to know what it means. What is it telling you? There are stories in that data. The EOBs has a story. The denial reasons has a story. No one is tracking them to see what is your most prevalent denial and why is it being denied. Our culture at MedAdvance, we try to collect everything. If it's $5 or $5,000 or $50,000, we go on every single penny. You work for it, we're going to go get it. All right? That's our culture. We fight. I mean, they get on the phone collecting. We have a standard protocol that after claims has been submitted, there's a 5 to 7 day guaranteed follow-up call to make sure the claim's on file. And we're fighting like, you know, to get make sure they pay at the benefit level that they're supposed to. But then two, industry data. Collectively, this industry, this space is the only space in healthcare that have not published collective data. Every other aspect of healthcare has collective data. We don't know what it costs to do a PHP in Georgia across the board. We know if you put 20 facilities in this room, the charge is going to be 20 different charges. We don't know the number of visits. How long do a client actually stay in treatment? What's the number of days of authorized services? We haven't collectively put that data together, and insurance payers know that. So they're using our fragmentation to deny claims based on the replacement of pre-existing conditions now with medical necessity. They're making you prove that what you've done is medically necessary. And they're going to deny and continue to deny claims until we're able to solidify our data positions. That's what we see. They're also taking the same data and using it to know the services being rendered in Florida or in Georgia or in Tennessee, that the clients are coming from, you know, Michigan, New Jersey, or Massachusetts, that they're saying, you know what, why are these clients leaving our territory to go to new jurisdiction for treatment? So they're going to make you have certain accreditation in order to treat the client. They're using the data against you, and we have the data. We're not using it to help us. So that's what we want to do. We want to put the transparency of the data and help analyze it to help you make, you know, good business decisions. The most important part, though, is a lot of facilities don't use the data to create marketing strategies behind it. You know, why are you having a marketer go out and solicit clients that pay you under market value? You know, you have Blue Cross Blue Shield that pays you a dime on the dollar, and you have, you know, health plan X that will pay you 25 cents on the dollar, but you he's bringing you or she's bringing you all the low-paying plans. Why would you lose money on that? Because we don't analyze the data. You just, all you're doing is saying, I got a client in the building. Not understanding, are you making money with that client? Or what do you need to do to change? And that data will give you these answers, but we're not analyzing. And you're going to need to start doing that because the insurance company, trust me, they have an analytic department that is looking at all of our algorithms to figure out how else can they not pay a claim.
Matt, did you have a comment?
Yeah, so the only thing I would add with regard to data, because all these are really good points, the only thing I would add would be if you're looking at what data do I need to grab at intake, okay, there's obviously the personal side, the history, the relationship that you need to build, there's no doubt. But the best way to figure out what you need to get at the beginning is to start at the end. So with the three or four payers that you're dealing with, or if it's 20 or 30, start with your top five. Start at the end. What are the data points that you know you're getting denied on? What are the data points they're looking for? And then make sure that you're capturing that up front. So many people kind of take their typical intake form, but there's no specificity to the payer. And so if you start at the end and work backwards, you're going to have a higher probability of success when you actually start at the beginning.
Thank you. Now I'd like to shift the conversation in a little bit different direction. So we talked about data and the importance of having that in terms of getting paid in behavioral health care, data on the marketing end before patients come in, capturing the right data as you go through the care delivery process through using like an electronic health record, then having that data communicated to the payer, giving them the data they're looking for in order to get paid in a timely manner, and then monitoring that data to ensure that you are getting paid effectively, efficiently, quickly, at the rate you're supposed to. Now I'd like to go in a little different direction. And Bill, I'm going to start with you because I know this is something you've talked about quite frequently across the country. So you're all collecting this data and you have information on how your care is being denied, or you have information on certain payer trends or whatever it might be. And this field still remains very fragmented, whether with it, it's in the addiction field itself, between addiction and mental health and eating disorders and developmental disability. We're still very siloed. And by bringing all that data together, by working together, there's an opportunity to make change to ensure that you do get paid for your services. Bill, can you talk about, I don't even need to lead any more on that. I know you have plenty to say on that topic.
Okay. Well, first of all, we don't have to be apologetic to get paid for the work we do. Hospitals don't apologize for what they service they render and what they get paid. Private practitioners in the medical field don't have to apologize. I think they've shined this light bright on addiction now because of the number of providers across the country. A lot has changed in this space. 3 years ago, individuals who were going to treatment would pay cash because they didn't want anybody to know they was in treatment. There was a stigma associated with them getting treatment. Well, the Affordable Care Act impacted that because now people have coverage who didn't have coverage, and people want to use those benefits. So what they were doing, for an example, a family would pay $10,000 a month out of pocket cash for their son or daughter to go into treatment to a facility A. But under the insurance, the deductible will be $5,000. So there's a family business decision, why not use your insurance, pay $5,000, and you will save $5,000 a month having not to pay cash for 10. That has all changed our whole space now. But here's the big element that's going on. We only have one enemy in this space, and it's not the insurance company. It is the addiction itself. We're on a mission to fight addiction. And if we fight it correctly, and uniformly, we can win. By doing that fight, it brings us together as advocates, speaking on behalf of those seeking sobriety. And part of that fight now goes to the insurance company to make sure they are reimbursing at the benefit level that they're required to. That's how cohesive we're supposed to be at this space. We're going all across the country. We did probably 30 of these in last year, and probably do 30 again this year, trying to educate the space that as long as we are divided, not coming together, sharing data, sharing information, clinical protocols, not creating a real uniformity, the insurance company is going to win. Because all they have to do is, you know, use the premise that it's very different in the same city and zip code with four different facilities within that jurisdiction. If we ask the people in this room right now, if you were on the same street and you did all PHP or IOP and asked what your rate would be, it would be five different rates. It will be five different protocols that we will determine what will be the clinical outcomes that we're going to be able to measure. We haven't come together on that yet. And a lot is because over the years, mental health and substance abuse services has gotten the black eye. Well, no longer do we have the black eye. The spotlight is very bright. Whenever there's promise, money comes. There's more equity companies today in this space than any other part of healthcare in the last 25 years. They're in this space because of the revenue generation that it brings to the table. So what does it mean? We got to operate better. We got to communicate better. We got to collaborate better. You should not leave this room today without knowing your colleagues in this space, what kind of protocols can we design for the state of Georgia. There are none. You can call the Department of Health in Georgia, and they wouldn't even tell you what it is. But why haven't we created it ourselves? And create a standard of care that we can live with knowing is at the highest level for a person seeking sobriety. What if it was your loved one who's fighting addiction? Wouldn't you want them to get the best level of care? What if it was you? Wouldn't you want the best care based on your condition? That there's a set of parameters that everyone will have to follow. Because what we do know, anytime there's money to be made in any space, whether it's healthcare or cars, people who have greed as their premise is going to enter the space. They'll do anything illegal to acquire clients. They'll do anything illegal to build insurance companies. Fraud will be rampant because they look at it as an opportunity to take advantage of those who are in need. I just think we're better as an industry when we come together and that we can put our brains and a lot of smarts in this room. You've been doing this a long time, but we haven't come together to figure out what would be great protocols. Can we have a set of standards that we can use? And then we should share them and make those persons who want to scheme, make them raise the bar. Because if their premise is to cheat, they don't want to raise the bar. They want to get by without doing anything. we can change that. That comes from advocates. And the first thing about treatment, you must be an advocate first. You got to be concerned about the person you're going to treat. And across the country, we are challenging every provider to become advocates. You know, just not a cliche, but by action. We got to come together. We got to unify. We got to fight addiction. And we only can do that with all the brains participating. And that's our quest today, to get you to understand how important that is.
And Matt, I'm going to have you continue on this point. Matt has been involved, particularly in the community mental health side, for a long time. And we have both witnessed as a trade association called the National Councils just exploded in the past 10 years as they've worked closer together. Matt, can you just tell us, you know, as you work with agencies across the country, you've seen agencies merge recently. You know, there's a lot to be said for working together. And I'm just curious, based on your background in politics and the behavioral healthcare field, if you'd like to elaborate on Bill's comments.
Sure. So as far as working together, certain states are far more organized than others. Nationally, the providers associations in Virginia and Arkansas, Pennsylvania stand out. They are very well organized, a lot of education, a lot of advocacy in their state capital. But one of the points that Bill makes is that the lack of standards. And so Credible, we're now up to over 300 agencies using the software. We've changed in the last year the way that we implement the software. And we are very prescriptive as opposed to reactive. So we tell agencies, this is the most efficient way to do intake to get to the outcomes that you're after or the payments that you're after, et cetera. And so we're starting to see amongst our 300 agencies, there are some standards, but pushing that out to larger groups, there's 10,000 entities in the U.S. that are providing some form of behavioral health or substance abuse, and that leaves out individual practitioners. There are no standards, which is interesting. But getting more organized, whether it's within the state or within counties, and working together, there's a huge payoff. And the providers in Arkansas, Pennsylvania, Virginia, we just see them operate at a much higher level. And we track their clean bill rates, and those states have the higher clean bill rates, and they've got better outcomes. And I think there's a strong correlation there.
Very interesting. It's very interesting. Well, in Georgia, I know the South is very competitive, and you can't be letting Arkansas and Virginia lead the field for you there. So when we come back in, a year or two, hopefully we'll be able to add Georgia to that list. Jason, I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that as well. You're relatively new to the field, and I think an outsider's perspective sometimes can really shed some light. As you look at the revenue cycle management process in this field, working with your clients and such, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of division, particularly Jason's in South Florida, where that seems to be very rife. Just you're picking up on Matt's and Bill's thoughts there, if you wouldn't mind.
Of course. From our perspective, it's interesting because we get approached by several different stages of treatment centers. So treatment centers will reach out to us in a time of need. They'll reach out to us in a launch program or in a growth program. They'll also reach us out to us. Private equity reaches out to us and says, hey, will you take a look at this and let us know if there's a better way to do marketing than what they have. And oftentimes, what we find in all of it but the startup is the relationship with whoever is doing the billing, it lacks all the connective points. It tends to lack. So in other words, from Matt's perspective and seeing it all the way, from the end working backwards, the cohesion there doesn't tend to be there. We can't in most instances get somebody to track how much it actually costs somebody to go into their care and where it comes from, let alone what it costs for them to go into care, then ultimately what it costs to treat that person. They tend to know that number. And then from there, ultimately, why is it happening? Why are we getting paid what we're getting paid? And I think Bill's point is spot on. There's power in numbers. There's ultimately power in numbers. And even if it doesn't come from the perspective of insurance companies, there's accountability. When you know that, hey, this is something that other people are struggling with, other treatment center owners, other treatment center management, this is what other people are also going through, it will either tell you you're doing a great job or it'll tell you that you're not. And there are services, you know, obviously the Medavances of the world from the billing side of it, the treatment calls of the world from the marketing side of it, the Credible from the software solution side of it, that can help us as providers ultimately link all of this stuff together. The services are there to give you the data. We're just not, there's the glue pieces. The glue pieces aren't happening. And I think that if the glue pieces were happening, and ultimately that's where you guys come in, the glue pieces were happening, you'd get paid more, people would get well more. The whole thing just works better together.
And Bill, let's talk about what you're seeing in terms of denials across the country. You know, Matt alluded to some states that are doing particularly well in terms of capturing data and such. And there have been some interesting anecdotes about denials. Dr. No is something that they featured on 60 Minutes. And Cigna recently pulled out of the healthcare exchange in Florida, claiming that abuse on the substance abuse side means they're just not going to do business in the exchange in the state anymore. Tell us what you're seeing out there as you work on behalf of your clients.
There's so much fraud in all of our society business. The insurance company today don't know who's good and who's bad, so they put all of us in one bucket. They've assembled in their mind that every single provider who sends them a claim didn't do something. That's their mentality right now. Until we're able to justify, you know, what is it that we need to be offering to quantify our services being good. Pre-existing condition has been substituted with medical necessity requests. The medical necessity request is being challenged by a person on the other end of the phone or at a desk who has no clinical expertise or any clinical acumen, and they're denying doctors who've been trained, who has assessed the client, and they're making the determination based on the script that they were given in training. I just don't think that's right. I think if a clinician has assessed his or her client and has made a determination that Bill McCormick need to be in treatment for 25 days, and this program is going to make Bill McCormick better, and there's benefit to cover the services, it should be granted. But that's the purpose of buying the premium. But that is not happening in our space. They're denying the upfront. They're requiring authorizations greater than ever before because they don't know who's doing what. They've also have the new one that came out just recently was challenging the level of training from the provider. When have we ever had that happen in the hospital? I mean, think about it. So if you go to the emergency room, they deny a claim because the emergency room doctor graduated from school they didn't like, and they denied a claim. If that happened, the hospital would own that insurance company. But in this space, they can make up a denial, put it on the EOB, and nobody says anything. It's just like normal protocol. They also, and I got this straight from the payers, they're denying claims to see if you challenge it. And if you don't, then they think that you are real bad, that you're not fighting for what you're entitled to. So why would you perform a service and not be willing to get paid for it? Makes no sense. So we got a lot of work to do and convincing them to understand that we are legitimate, we're working with clean hands, and we want to be paid for what we do. I think that is not asking for anything that any other provider, any other spectrum of healthcare is asking. But until we can make that fight and make that plea loud and clear, we'll continue to see these patterns of denials coming. You get EOBs, their facility never even checked the EOB. They tear the check off, check goes to the bank, and EOB goes to a file. They have no understanding of what the EOB said. And they're denying, and then next week, you get another batch, then you deny those as well. Nobody's saying anything. No one is challenging them. They violating the parity. They wouldn't do this in any other spectrum of healthcare. No one is filing suits to challenge this. And they're saying the provider has to do it. You have to do it. You're the treatment owner. So you basically can give an unjust enrichment. You provide the services. They got paid for it and not paying you for it. You know, so it's going to continue until we're able to, you know, get foothold. And there are some movement going on across the country. I'm very happy to see several coalitions been formed. Matter of fact, hopefully this time next week, the greatest news in this space, where there is a group of retired judges have come together at a request to support and defend these treatment centers against these payers. And that will be the first time ever in the history of any part of our society where a group of retired judges have come together and formed a legal coalition to fight this parity violation. So look forward to hearing that information hopefully next week.
And Bill is, I think you're probably the first people on the planet that Bill has told that to. So you in Atlanta have some privileged information. I think you didn't mention that yesterday because you like people in Atlanta better.
I was waiting for my
home. For your home in Georgia.
Charity starts a home and spread abroad.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, Matt, you know, picking up on Bill's comments, what are you seeing as you talk to, you're very dialed in across the country, both on advocacy, working with your clients and such. What are you hearing from your clients in terms of things that they're experiencing with payers that is, you know, keeping them up at night and such?
Sure. So Credible's in 27 different states today. And in some of the states, for the larger agencies, we actually are their outsourced billing group. So we see a lot of the things that Bill's folks see as well. When we come into an agency, regardless of the state, we are always amazed at how many times they send a bill out or send out an 837 or they drop it to paper and they send it out, and then they don't check to see if there's a quick denial, an initial denial, if it gets pended. People just don't check. So first of all, you need to outline the process. That process needs to be on someone. If you're a solo practitioner, it needs to be on your whiteboard. If you're an agency, executive management needs to understand what is that process. I mean, when I grew up, and you may not remember this at all, but there was something called Schoolhouse Rock, and there was how a bill becomes a law. Your billing people and your senior management people, you need to know how a bill becomes cash in your bank. And if you don't have that workflow, then I guarantee you there's cash that's dropping off along the way, okay? Companies like Bill's, they know that whole process, and when they get a new payer in, the first thing they do, I'm pretty sure, if I went to his office, is they map out, hey, how does this payer make it work, and how do we make that better? So oftentimes people send out the bill and they don't follow up. What we see across the country, again, it depends on the state and the organization of the state. The payers have a policy, some payers are worse than others, to initially deny, okay? And knowing that a certain percentage of the people are not going to reply to that, and they're just going to take it. Or, kind of, it was great that Maggiano's cooperated, and they brought out the bread, and so people are like, okay, lunch is on its way, and I'm kind of happy with the bread, and if they screw up everything else, at least I got some bread, okay? They're going to give you back $20 for a $60 service. You're going to cash that check, and you may forget that I've got to go after the other 40, okay? It's the same thing. So there are a couple processes you can put in place is when you send out the bill, whether it's paper, whether it's electronic, make sure you know what the answer is on the other side, okay, and follow up. But getting back to what we see across the country, there are different cultures in each state. You know, Minnesota has a very specific culture, Arkansas has a culture, Georgia has a culture, and the insurance companies leverage that as well. Once they start seeing an agency that can easily show, here's medical necessity, here's what we need for an authorization, they tend to pay that agency quicker because they know it's not worth their time to fight it. It's much better to deny all these other folks. And we've seen it in Pennsylvania with Value Behavioral Health. Credible triggered a bunch of audits because the clean bill rate for payers was so high that their own software said, hey, something's wrong here, they must be committing fraud. And then they dug into it, and we jumped in and worked out. So Value basically will quick pay claims that come through Credible because they know it's clean. They know that if they fight it, they're going to lose. And so you want to be one of those payers, regardless of the vendor that you use or if you go with outsourced billing, which if you're in it for the care, I highly recommend it. Regardless of what you do, if you're really good at it, they're going to realize it and they're going to start quick paying you.
Interesting. I would not want to be the payer who calls up Matt Dorman and says, we suspect some fraud here. That would not be a position I want to be in. Bill either, because they will fight back, knowing these gentlemen. Now, Chase, I want to skip to you for a second, because I think one of the issues that you and I have talked about that a lot of providers struggle with is there are clients that, unfortunately, they cannot admit. Their revenue models are just not based on whatever financial resources the client has. And let's face it, a lot of people with addiction do not have financial resources. And you work with a lot of families. You hear the calls. You work with the treatment centers. You know, what are you finding just, you know, when a treatment center gets a call and they realize, you know what, this is not a client that we can financially sustain, because let's face it, if you scholarshiped everybody, you wouldn't be in business. I'm just curious, based on your perspective, what are you recommending to your treatment centers when, unfortunately, they have to say that they can't be a resource?
So it's important to kind of know the stats on that, too. It's better than 85% of the calls will not be a fit either clinically, culturally, or financially for your center. That's just the reality of how the phone calls are going to come in. With that, that leaves, you know, the stuff that might be a fit might not be. But I think as an industry, what I observe is an industry that seems numb to what's actually going on the other end of the phone. The way that people are handled or mishandled is oftentimes, it really makes me sad. We've heard last breaths on some calls. We've heard the worst of the worst stories that I could ever imagine, and I'm sure that echoes the sentiment of some of you who have been in this space for a long time. When we're just handing them a hotline number that gets them, again, to another treatment center potentially, that gets them to another hotline number, that just gets them to another hotline number, we're not actually spending the time that's necessary. There are options for people out there, and I think that as, if nothing else, as human beings, we have the obligation to get these people somewhere that can actually help them. On the calls that do have some form of insurance, you would be, especially if you're buying calls or you're spending any money at all on marketing, you would be silly not to use that as relationship building tools with centers all over the country. If somebody's calling in a state that requires them to stay there, be it, you know, court ordered or otherwise, why would you not reach out to a center in that state and forge a relationship with them? Again, like Bill said, the only competition we have in this is the addiction itself, but more than competition, there's cooperation that can happen when synergies happen between treatment centers. If you're not attending these things and getting business cards, if you're not attending local conferences or national conferences and trying to find centers that from an ethics and core values perspective aligns with you, you're missing the opportunity to utilize what you're spending ultimately on marketing. And here's a secret, what they're also spending on marketing, right? Because it's going to come back, right? You're missing a huge opportunity to not only maximize your dollar on marketing, but ultimately to help people. If you need a list or don't know where to send people, would you grab me after this? That's something that I'm committed to, that we're committed to, is to making sure that these people end up at the right place. It's something that, again, just as a person that I think should resonate. And again, if you're taking phone calls and you find yourself, you know, in the mundane nature that I feel like we kind of get into, remember that's somebody's mom, that's somebody's dad or sister or brother. That's somebody that oftentimes, again, this was an instance that happened that caused them to call you. This could be something that has been building up for decades. This is oftentimes the first call that somebody's made. And when they're greeted with something other than compassion and love and care and hope, that's what they're asking for on these calls. They're not looking for, you know, well, we're on the beach and we have, you know, they're looking for hope. Understand that. That's what they're asking for. So if we take them from hopeless to hopelessless to hopelessless, right? Because all we keep doing is passing them off to somebody who can't help them. I really think we're doing a disservice to the people that are calling.
Matt, as, you know, there's a lot of information that's been provided today. And I'm just curious, after lunch, as people are driving back to their office or home in Atlanta traffic, which is like nothing I've ever seen before, what would you like them to just keep in the back of their mind about getting paid in behavioral health care? What do you think is the most important nugget to take away from today's discussion?
So I think you guys have to be the judge of what the most important nugget is. I can offer, you know, two to three out there. I mean, one, the majority of Credible's partner agencies, so what other people call customers, we call partners, the majority of them are Medicaid funded. They're taking Medicaid at some point. And we have some that they're nonprofits, some are for-profits, and they are doing very well. So there's a perception that I can't make money if I'm serving Medicaid population, which is wrong, okay? In Maryland, mathematically, you cannot make money if you operate a clinic, just the way that Maryland reimburses everything. So some states, it's mathematically impossible as a clinic, but as individual provider, you can. So on the previous question about what do? How do you help people? You know, you should be looking at the different payers that you deal with, and if you're not, you know, Medicaid is kind of last resort, but you want to look at Medicaid, Medicare, where it applies. Nuggets, start at the end. Understand your biggest challenge. Understand that flow. So if your biggest challenge is how do I get paneled with the payers, find out first what are the best payers to be paneled with, okay? And then, you know, you want to contact them and be persistent until you get the right people and get you the right answers so that you can get set up appropriately. Then find out, again, starting at the end and work backwards, what is their workflow, what are they going to need, and then make sure that you can provide it. And if there's something in their flow that you absolutely can't do, don't do it, okay? Don't go down a path that you're going to fail at. So understanding the workflow, making sure that you have a good kind of basket of payers so you have different options you can work with, that's big. And take the time to step back and look at the data. You know, you all took time to come get a free lunch and a lot of other goodies, okay? You've got time to step back and look at, you know, what are the payers that aren't paying you enough? What are the payers that are too slow, and look at the processes there, because there's a lot of answers in the data. You just got to take the time to analyze them.
Now, before we move into your free lunch, I do want to give you some time to ask some questions to our panelists. But before we do that, can I have a round of applause for these gentlemen?
Thank you.
Okay, so I promised you Phil Donahue. Hopefully no Jerry Springer. Any questions for today's speakers? Okay, we have one right here. If you wouldn't mind telling us who you are and where you're from.
I'm Stacy Seichel. I'm Chief Medical Officer of Riverman Health Center here in Atlanta. I've been Chief Medical Officer of some other startups funded through private equity. So I've been on this road a while, and prior to that, not-for-profits, Medicaid, in-network providers. And I am a patient advocate is at my core. And I have had a couple questions. First is, you said there are no protocols for the state of Georgia, and those need to be created. So, Bill, were you referring to, like, protocols for all that we do, such as screening, intake, levels of care, treatment, like a intake protocol? I'm not quite sure what you were referring to.
Let me clarify when I make that reference. With your experience, how many people know Stacy in this room? Raise your hand.
I just moved to Atlanta from Orlando. If this was Orlando,
Orlando, they would know you. Okay. Well, here's the point I was trying to make. If they got people like Stacy who has expertise, who's been in the clinical side of treating people for years, I'm sure, there should be a standard of care in Georgia that every provider must meet, at least a minimum standard of care, that is published and uniform. So if you want to open an IOP in Georgia, you must meet 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. If you don't meet that, then you shouldn't be licensed to provide services.
But those are in our state standards when we get an IOP license with the state of Georgia.
Okay, and who monitors those? Exactly. No, but here's what they've done. They'll let you get a license, but no one checks to see if it's being performed. And you renew the next year. And clients are going in and out of these facilities over and over and over again, and no one is monitoring that protocol of care. That's what's I mean, in Maryland, you mentioned Maryland, if you wanted to do a recovery residence, there's a state law that if three people without a common relationship can't even live in the same house. So that model would not work in the state of Maryland. So you can't be husband and wife, cousin, outside of that three people, and stay in the same house and get treatment. That makes no sense to me. And they're not fighting that. So I challenge them to go after the state to have that fixed. Here's another issue. In California, or actually in certain states, where the federal plan makes the payment to the client. Is that not like the most asinine thing you ever heard? You go to treatment, and the check goes to the patient who just in recovery. $60,000, $40,000. So what do you think is going to happen? Relapse. Because no one has fought the standard of care to say, if we provide these services, health insurance, do not send my check to the client. Even with assignment of benefits, they still send a check to the client. They would not do that for a hospital. It would not happen. That's the advocacy of the protocol of care that I'm speaking of.
Okay, so in Florida, if we're licensed by the state, or IOP, Patriot Residential Detox, they come and audit us. I mean, we're audited by the state. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that doesn't happen?
In a lot of states across the country, it does not happen. In some states, we have found that there's no follow through on, and we've heard several. I mean, this is state 19 now, at least that many, and I would say half of the states. Matter of fact, in California, you don't even have to have a license to get IOP. Imagine that. There's no license required. So you have these kind of inconsistencies, but that's why it should be a national set of standards that everyone should meet, and then that the state be the ones who enforce them. It's really simple. I mean, the hospitals, if you go to the emergency room, there are national protocols on emergency room procedures that you have to have, and no doctor has to meet them, or they don't get paid or get accredited. We should be no different. We raise the standard of care, we have a better fight against insurance companies.
Matt, is there anything you would like to add on that particular topic?
So what we see is the larger the entity, the more follow-up. You know, so in Florida, there are licensing. In Maryland, for instance, they have said that every entity that serves more than X number of people needs to either be JCO or CARF certified. And so there are things like that. But I think what Bill's also talking about is there isn't a standard protocol for service from A to Z, and there's a great deal of variance. I mean, Pennsylvania, we have 50-plus agencies, and the way that they handle whether wraparound services or intake or whatever, there's 50 different styles. And there's a lot of variance versus in the hospital world, things are a lot more standardized.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I do want to move into lunch. These gentlemen are here. They're happy to answer your questions. They also speak across the country. Bill and Jason and Matt are at they'll be at the National Conference on Addiction Disorders, other conferences, Bill's State of Recovery Conference. They're all over the place. They're happy to answer your questions here. I'm delighted you could join us. Can I have another round of applause for my panelists?
Thank you.
Few housekeeping notes as they bring in the salads. Please just remember to fill in your CE evaluation form before you leave. If you haven't picked up your gift card, please also do so. There is dessert. It's Maggiano's dessert, so please enjoy. They will also box up any leftovers, and you're welcome to take them with you. Enjoy lunch and dinner on us. Thank you.
And a very quick announcement, you should have received the email already for the State of Recovery Conference, July 21st and 22nd in Fort Lauderdale. Everyone in this room, you and two guests, I will pay your registration fee for the conference if you decide to come. You have until the end of the month. I'll give you to the end of the month if you want to come. You should have already received the email. So if you're here, you get to bring yourself and two guests, and then I will cover your registration fee. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Enjoy your lunch.